So remember, for an edge on the graph, we had a closed algebra with Poisson brackets of holonomies and fluxes. And what we wanted to do is to quantize this. So we wanted to represent the functions of holonomies as some operators, as operators on some space of functions. So we chose as this space of functions to be functions which take elements of SU2 and give back a complex number. So they take some group element G and they map it to a number psi of G. And the most natural choice for the functions of holonomy was for them to act as multiplicative operators. So the same as in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you chose the operator X to be multiplicative. The function of holonomies on this space of functions acts multiplicatively. And trivially, because complex numbers commute, this commutativity transfers to functions of holonomies. And we satisfy this Poisson bracket. So the whole point is to make these Poisson brackets into commutative. Sorry. Okay, and then what we did was we looked at how flux acts on the holonomy, and we defined the Lie derivative. And then we defined the action of flux on this space of functions as just the Lie derivative on the function. So what we had in the end is how holonomy and flux act on this space. The next thing that we wanted to have to make a Hilbert space is to define some kind of an inner product of these states. In order to do that, we needed to have a product which is invariant to a right group translation. And we could do that by using the Haar measure. So Haar measure is a measure on the manifold of the Lie group. It works for compact Lie groups. And it's invariant on multiplying G by AG or G on the right. Or it's the same for G to the minus one. It has these nice properties. So to make an inner product of two states, we just integrate over all group elements of the group. And yeah, that's the inner product. So now what we have is our space of functions. We have how our operators act on this space. We have an inner product. And the last thing that we want is an orthonormal basis. For this, we can use the Peter Weyl theorem. What this theorem says is that as an orthonormal basis, we can take all the matrix elements of all the irreducible representations. In this case, we have an SU2 group. Irreducible representations are marked with G. So these are all the different spins, so 1/2, 1, 3/2, and so on. And the matrix elements are M, N. So these things are the vectors in the orthonormal basis. And they are basically, when they act on a group element from SU2, we just get a matrix, which is in J representation of SU2, and it's MN matrix elements. Right. And it has this property that when you sum over all J's and then over all MNs, you get the identity operator. And the interesting thing about this is that you can actually look at it as having a sum over J's, so all the spins, and then so for each vertex in the graph, you have a J representation of the SU group. So that's what we did last time.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. I think it was quite clear, and it's good that we have a, since yesterday it was a bit technical, it's quite nice that you did this nice summary to make sure that everyone is clear with what we did. So, yeah, so where are we now and what are we going to do today? So as I told you, today we're going to have a short introduction on loop quantum cosmology, and it's going to be done by Aurélien Barraud. And, but before that, I want to first go back on this. So now we have an edge, which is quantized. And so you can see this edge as carrying now an irreducible representation of SU2. And the endpoints of this edge are carrying the magnetic number. And so, of course, you're going to see that this edge is going to be, in the full theory, is going to be part of a graph. So this means that now you will have many other edges coming to this node, meaning that here at this node, you will have many magnetic number. And we will see that the constraint, the Gauss constraint, and then the flatness constraint are going to, first the Gauss constraint are going to constrain this magnetic number, okay? And then the Gauss the flatness constraint are also going to constrain the G representation around closed loop, okay? So we'll come back on that later. But first, already with just this, so here we have a Hilbert space for our subsystem, which is just one edge, and we can already look at the length operator and see one of the main results of loop quantum gravity, which is quite important to understand the loop quantum cosmology approach. So let me just define what is the length operator. So I'm just going to give you, so first, length. Operator, so we want to, we have our curl gamma, so again, let's go back to gamma, and the dual curve, because what we are going to be able to measure is going to be the length, or I'm going to call them E now, let's say E, it's going to be the length of the associated to the dual curve, and we want to build an operator acting on our state basis, okay? But so what is the length of a curve? It will be given if you remember that you need to have access to the spatial metric, and then this can be written in terms of the cotriad. So if the length of the curve then is going to be given as you need to have this number, okay? So the delta IJE. And then you look at the tangent vector, you contract with the tangent vector of this curl. And then of course you need an integration . And so heuristically, how this operator is defined is that, so if you go now, if you approximate this integral by the Riemann sum, okay, then what you can more or less write is that indeed here you have a sum over, and then you can use this, so for small, here for small section of your, so you cut your edge in small section, okay, like in the Riemann sum approximation, and then you go to the limit, and here you can use then the flux variable, okay? So the idea to define here, so this is the definition, so this is just an heuristic argument, but you are going to come back on this length operator in the next homework, okay, where you will have to read an article on the definition of this length operator, but in the context of Lorentzian signature, okay, not the Euclidean one, and see what are the differences. So you will come back on this, and maybe you will have a better definition. So here, this is the definition of as an operator associated, so with edge E. And we want to compute this action on this state. So first, Barbara already recalled you that this flux variable, this flux operator is defined as the left invariant derivative. And also it can be written in terms of the right translation, so of EH bar. And here you have the exponential, the right translation for this group element, exponential of t. Okay, so this is just a reminder. So now let's look, we want to define what is this, find what is this action of this operator on our basis. This means we want to compute and of course here I forgot that then you need to take t to zero, evaluate at t is equal to zero on but so let's evaluate this function on a given group, okay, to make appear the group matrix element here. So let's look at the right action, the right translation on this matrix element. Okay, which means here that, of course, you have some, this is exactly, you evaluate this action of the right action at a given group element G, the right action on your vector basis here. Okay, so this is that, and there was some normalization with the dimension of the representation J. Okay, so this is equal. So by definition, this is the matrix element where you multiply by so the right, okay? And then these are just matrix elements. So you can use the matrix product where of course here's a P. There is a sum on the P indices. And so what is this return in term of the vector basis? This is G, the vector, this vector evaluated at G. It's a P now. Time, so maybe I should write explicitly this sum over P, otherwise you can forget about it, P and G of, there is a, you want to notice that here it should be H, okay? So here it's a H. So from here we can deduce what is the right translation on our vector basis. So what do you get? You get that it's the sum over P of this matrix element times this vector basis. And so from that, of course, you deduce the action on the of the flux operator on our basis vector. And this is just given by, so you just apply this. Okay. So by definition, it's each I H bar, and then you have a sum over P of this GM. And then you have the derivative respect to t, then you will evaluate at zero of, it's a pn here, and then it's the exponential of t So here it's indeed the matrix representation of this group element, but then when you take the derivative with respect to t and you evaluate at t is equal to 0, you get the matrix representation of a Lie algebra element. Okay, so here you can then simplify this and you get again Pn of, so here instead of, yeah, it's a k. Because otherwise I have too many j. It's not the same j. So it's a k. Okay, here j is a representation of SU2, whereas here it's just an index, internal index. So here it's a k. Don't get confused with all these indices. So now what is the action of this length operator that I define like this on our vector basis? We get that is going to be, so IH squared, so it's minus H bar squared. Then we got a sum over, let's call them PQ of GMQ. So I just apply twice this operator. And then I get the sum over K. So I have a PQ TK time J, Q N TK. Is that correct? Oh. No, here I guess I inverse. Q is some here, so it's QP, sorry. P. Okay, so Q, Q, P, P, okay, N and M. Okay, so now what can we say here? What is this object? Here we are just, we have matrix elements. So here you can see that as a multiplication, the matrix element of, with indices Q, N of TK, TK, which is and let's call this object, so this is a matrix element. And you could check, but you should maybe know that from SU2 already, if you're a bit familiar with the group SU2, that this matrix is going to commute with any matrix representation of a Lie algebra element, meaning that here if I have ML, let's say, of T, this commutator is 0. So what does it mean here? This means that this object is the Casimir, okay? So this is a Casimir, what we call a Casimir operator. And are you familiar with the Shor's lemma? Or it's going to tell you that an operator which commutes with all the generator here is going to be proportional to the identity. So this means that C so here Cj is the Casimir of SU2 modulo a constant. And you can compute easily. Sorry? So you can just, so this is just for, if you want to do it with the sigma matrices, you can check it easily, but it's, you need to, yeah. Yeah, so here it just, you take the norm more or less of the, if you see that as a vector, okay, the norm of your, and then you can check that with all of them, it's going to be. And here you can check what is this lambda in the case of this particular SU2 group. So this you can compute it yourself. You get here a minus because here I'm not talking about the sigma matrices, but I'm talking about the two, which and this relation is with the I. So you get a minus. And you get this value, which depends just on this irreducible representation. So what does it mean now here? This means that here you see that what we're going to get, since it's the identity, we're going to get that the action of this length operator on this state is diagonal, okay? And we have this eigenvalue. The spectrum is given by this minus. So here, now we can deduce. H bar square and of course in the beginning we forgot we put you know in front of the action remember we put this kappa is equal to 1 so we don't have any dimension here but if you go back with the unit in fact you can show that in front of what is in front of here is if you add if you go back to something with unit, then you will get the length, the Planck length, the 3D one, because it's not the same expression as for the 4D, square time j plus 1. And but so here, what is really important is what you get is a discrete spectrum. And it's really what we're going to use in the loop quantum cosmology approach. Okay, this is a very important result from loop quantum gravity is that you have space which is discrete. So of course here we are in 3D, so we just have access to this length operator. But in 4D, we're going to, you can look at the area operators and the volume operators. And again, you will find that you have discrete a discrete spectrum. And what is also important is that, in fact, the J is equal to 0 is not allowed in the spin network description. So what you have is a minimum area gap. Okay, you cannot get area equal to 0. You get a minimum area. And this is what is going to make that we have it's, there is a big change in the loop quantum cosmology approach. Okay, so just before showing you the video on the loop quantum cosmology, I just want to say a few words on that. So first, yeah, some question, yeah.
So the length operator.
Yeah.
We are measuring the length of the dual curve, but why do we give it state on the edge? I'm still not being able to connect those two.
Because, so in fact, and it's going to be the same in 4D. So we are just going to work now with graph, okay. And of course, you always have a dual graph associated to a given graph, okay? And we're going to, and in 4D, even when we are in 3D, so in 4D, we will have, in the canonical approach, we will have space will be three-dimensional. So here, we will have graph on three-dimensional space, and the flux will be living on the dual surface associated to its edge. And the area operator, what is really going to measure, is going to measure the area of this dual surface, but we never represent them. And you always say that the E is also going to be associated to this edge. So but now what does it mean? What is the picture that you have? So let's, for example, talk about 3D, 4D, because it's easier to see the picture. So now you have on your space is described by graph, okay? And these graphs are going to carry, like we have here, we're going to carry irreducible representation on the edge, and we will see that even in 3D, once we will have imposed the Gauss constraint, we will get here what we call intertwiner, okay? So it's another number, okay? And so let's call E1, E2. And so each of these quantum number is going to be, so the irreducible representation J are going to be associated, are going to characterize the area of the dual surface. So here you can really see this as characterizing a dual surface, and here it's going to characterize the volume. So, but you see that here you have many edges, so here what it's going to give you, so for each edge you have this dual surface, and of course it's going to close because of this Gauss constraint. So here, this represents a volume of space, and it gives you the value, this I is going to characterize the value of this volume as a quantum, quantum number, okay? And so you really have a picture where now you have atoms of space, and, but you only need the information of the graph because all the information is contained in this quantum number, okay? And so the representation, we don't represent space. Usually we don't represent the atom of space, but it's just that indeed this this edge with this number here is going to characterize the area of the dual surface, okay? And then exactly, since you have this constraint, it's going to constrain all the other surface in order that first it's closed in a polyhedra, and that the volume of this object is characterized by this number, okay? So this is, you, in fact, for the picture, we just use the graph, but then the picture is really atoms of space, okay? But you just need the information of the graph, in fact. Okay? You have another question, Barbara?
Yeah, I was just wondering what is the relation between the quantized length that we got and the fact that here we approximate the sum.
No, so here it just, and then, yeah, but then of course you take the, so it just to give you an idea that indeed when you go to the discrete case, here what you have is this small, what you could consider as a flux variable. But then of course you take the limit, so then you're just having this, okay, in the continuum, it's just to give you more or less an idea of why you have the flux is variable here, but indeed it's not a very clean description. Okay, so hopefully with the article you will have for the second homework, you will have a better description than just that. It's just I didn't want to spend too much time on that because I want to show you the other things. But to give you, maybe it was not a good idea. I still wanted to justify why we are using this formula, but yeah, it's the step. It's not like this implied directly.
Okay.
It's not very. Okay, so yeah, I will take just a few minutes to do my short introduction because then, so I asked Aurélien to do a video for you and I asked him for 15 minutes, but he likes to talk. But his, what he said is really good, so I don't want to cut his video, but it's 30 minutes, so I really have to. Yeah. Okay, so I just want to give you what is the idea of loop quantum cosmology. So the idea is to, of course, you know that in classically, GR can be applied also to the universe as a whole, but then you're approximating usually the space-time geometry with the homogeneous isotropic metric, where this means that then you're talking about Friedman, Robertson, and Walker cosmology, which is given by this metric here, which is described really a homogeneous and isotropic space-time. So in, if in the quantum theory we want to describe at the quantum level this kind of spacetime, normally we are expecting first to start from GR, the complete GR, then to quantize, so to get to loop quantum gravity. But so this means that this in 4D we need to have the complete theory. And even if I haven't talked about 4D yet, I guess you all know that we don't have a complete theory. Otherwise it would be well known that we have a theory of quantum gravity. But it's not really the case. So this means that in 4D, we need to have the physical state, which are the state annihilated by the Hamiltonian constraint. And we see that in 4D, it's where we are a bit stuck for the moment. And then from this physical state, we will go to try to find an approximation for representing a homogeneous and isotropic spacetime, where since we will be in the quantum description, of course, you will always have a fluctuation around this because we cannot fix everything because of uncertainty principle. You cannot have homogeneous and isotropic, but it will be an approximation, okay? So this is normally the way you're expecting to describe this kind of space-time at the quantum level. But since we don't have this, the other idea is to say, okay, so let's try starting from GR and then to go to this simplest space-time, which are homogeneous and isotropic, described by this kind of metric. And then we're going to quantize using what we learned from loop quantum gravity, so using the same kind of variable, meaning holonomies, and in particular holonomies, and the same tools that we are using in loop quantum gravity to get to a quantum description. And this is loop quantum cosmology. And what you're expecting, so why are we interested in cosmology? So one of the motivation to go to a theory of quantum gravity was that we have in GR, we have some singularity, meaning that the theory cannot be applied anymore. And in particular, we have this Big Bang singularity. So the idea is that with a theory of quantum gravity, can we solve this singularity? And the answer from loop quantum cosmology, even if it's not everything is not checked yet, is that indeed the singularity is resolved in this context. So you are going to see. And so in this video, Renia is also going to give you which kind of prediction also could be made using loop quantum cosmology. And really the important point about loop quantum cosmology is, so you will have also the tutorial this afternoon about that, is that because we have this discrete spectrum here of the area, this means that now, because now space-time is homogeneous and isotropic. So this means that in fact you could look at your space using some cells, which are, for example, some square or cubic cells, okay? And just focus on one given cell for the moment to look at the dynamics. And so when you are going to describe your holonomy, you are going to see that in fact you can simplify this kind of holonomy to very simple object because of this, the fact that you are in space-time, which is homogeneous and isotropic. But then when you want to compute the Hamiltonian is going to be, you can write the Hamiltonian in terms of holonomies, okay? Well, this is the idea of loop quantum gravity, is to, instead of working with the connection, you work with the holonomies, okay? Because of course, initially, the Hamiltonian is going to be written just in terms of the connection, but here the idea is to try to use the fact that you have holonomies. But here, since we know that the area, we have a minimum area, okay? This means that you cannot here have a square area going to zero. So the holonomy will have to be more or less to be regularized. And doing this, you get a new Hamiltonian. And this new Hamiltonian now is going to be much simpler because it's going to be a difference equation, not a differential equation, but a difference equation. And I think it's the starting point of Aurélien. So hopefully you will be able to follow what he's doing. Yeah, thanks.
Hello. So Maite has very kindly asked me to give you a 15-minute lecture on singularity resolution and observational consequences in loop quantum cosmology. So obviously, I will not have time to go into the details. This is why I have already written most of the equations to try to spend time extracting physics from them and not trying to derive them, which would obviously require hours, if not days. And I also apologize for my terrible French guy pronunciation. I hope you will understand at least something. So the key point here I want to make is to try to let you understand how if the Big Bang singularity resolved in loop quantum cosmology. You know that the usual Einstein equations are leading to a kind of pathology of space-time in the sense that they are singular, which means that the theory is not correct. I mean, space-time is not ill. What is ill, of course, is the model we are using to describe it. One possible way to try to go beyond Einstein theory is to go to the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, which is the most simple and naive quantization of Einstein's equation. The problem is that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is usually still singular. I mean, the Big Bang pathology is not cured in a generical way in the Wheeler-DeWitt approach. And a very important and interesting point is that loop quantum cosmology evades the uniqueness von Neumann theorem because it is inequivalent to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation already at the kinematical level, which means that already at a kinematical level something new happens, and this will lead to the singularity resolution. What happens is that instead of differential equation, we end up with a kind of difference, finite difference equation. Psi is the wave function of the universe. And the key point is that if you begin from our expanding large classical universe, that is big values of this L integer, and if you go backward in time, the Big Bang would correspond to L equal 0, to a vanishing N. But the point is that you can continue to negative values of N, and this physically corresponds to the contracting branch of the universe. And this is a Big Bang's picture. There is a contracting branch of the cosmic history before the expanding branch in which we are living. The key point is that this singularity resolution, which is a mathematical consequence of this equation, has a clear meaning in terms of quantum geometrical effect. There is a repulsive force which somehow stabilizes the universe, just like the usual hydrogen atom is stabilized by the Heisenberg principle. So the key point is that this result was shown to still hold for many different cases. For all the exactly solvable models, that is, with a massless scalar field in a flat universe, with a positive curvature, negative curvature, positive and negative cosmological constants, and even more importantly, for anisotropic universes, that is, for a wide class of Bianchi models that are very relevant in this kind of cosmological settings. It has also been shown numerically that most of the quantum dynamics is usually well encoded in the semi-classical behavior, which is very interesting for phenomenological purposes. So let me right now begin with an FLRW metric, where A is the scale factor of the universe and N is a Lax function. So you have a pair of conjugate variables with a non-vanishing Poisson bracket. Gamma is a Barbero Emir Z parameter, which is irrelevant in standard general relativity, but which plays an important role when quantizing the theory. This is a fiducial volume, and this delta function here is basically the area gap for the eigenvalues of the area operator in loop quantum gravity. You can then compute the Hamilton function, and a very interesting result is that instead of b square root of delta here, you have this sine function. And the origin of this sine function is that there is no operator associated with the Hdkr connection loop gravity, but only with its holonomy, which is somehow obvious when you understand the way curvature is measured in standard general relativity, and which also is reminiscent of the concept of Wilson loops in particle physics. From this Hamiltonian, it is straightforward to compute the resulting Friedmann equation. If you remove this term, you recognize the standard general relativistic Friedmann equation, right? The square Hubble parameter is equal to the density of the universe, and we know, it's obvious, that if you evolve backward in time this equation, you end up with a singularity, rho goes to infinity. And here, just because of this quadratic term, rho times rho, with a minus sign, and minus sign is non-trivial. This is not what happens, for example, in brain world cosmology. So because of this negative sign in front of the quadratic correction, now it is completely clear that rho is bounded from above at the value of the critical density, which is of the order of the Planck density. So it means that everything becomes regular. And you can even compute the equivalent of the Recheverry equation in the framework of loop quantum cosmology, and obviously it is also modified with this correction. The very important point is that this phenomenological result has also been obtained in different frameworks. You know, the problem in the so-called mini-superspace approach is that you first use the symmetries and then you quantize. I mean, this is somehow obvious to try to do that, and as Romilly says, there is no physics without approximation, but still, this is not what you would like to do. In this quantum reduced to quantum gravity model, they do it the other way around. They begin by quantizing and then the symmetry reduce the model. This is very, very good. The problem is that the price to pay is a kind of gauge fixing. So the question is still open. But the very nice point is that now the Hamiltonian function can still be calculated. There is this additional term, but as you can obviously see from it, the Big Bang singularity is still resolved. There are some open discussions about what happens in the contracting branch of the universe. It could be emergent instead of contracting, but that's not the point. Singularity is still resolved in this approach. And most interestingly, this is still true in so-called group field theory. You know, in group field theory, what happens is that you basically understand the large-scale cosmological dynamics as a kind of hydrodynamical limit of the fundamental group field theory degrees of freedom in the so-called Gross-Pitayevsky approximation. And very importantly, you still recover the modified Friedmann equation with just a kind of rescaling of the critical energy density, which is not of very high relevance for my purpose here. So I would consider the Big Bang revolution as something very robust in loop gravity. How to go beyond that? I mean, the first thing to do is to try to compute in a very accurate and better way the dynamics of the background, right? This is what we can do first. So we define two variables, x and y, is the square root of the potential and kinetic energy densities contained in the massive scalar field that I assume to be the main constituent of the universe. And you can derive the evolution of the density in the remote part of the contracting branch of the universe. And the interesting point is that you see that it is pseudo-periodic, with delta playing the role of a phase. And this is something important. Why? Because it has been claimed that loop quantum cosmology predicts inflation. And that's correct. But that's not a big deal. I mean, inflation is a very strong attractor. So if you put a scalar field in the universe with the correct potential, and you begin at the Planck density, you will nearly unavoidably end up with inflation. This is not something very impressive. What is very impressive is that loop quantum cosmology predicts how much inflation you have. Let me explain you why. Because now we have this contracting phase of the universe before the bounce. And because of that, it's completely obvious that delta is the variable on which you would like to which you would like to assign a flat PDF, a flat probability distribution function. Because delta is contingent. There is no reason for physics to have chosen a specific value of delta. In addition, you can mathematically show that a flat PDF for delta is preserved over time. If you do that, just because there are highly non-linear relations between x, the fraction of potential energy, and delta, for nearly all the values of delta, you have the same value of x, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 6. It means that x is not anymore a random variable as in standard general relativity. Now the value of x, except if you fine-tune the model, is predicted by loop quantum cosmology. And what is very nice is that the value of x tells you how much e-folds of inflation you have, because they are both isomorphic one to the other. And you can compute that the PDF for the number of e-folds of inflation is now something like that, peaked around 140. I like very much this number of 140, because it is above 70, and you know that 70 is the value which is required by observation, so hopefully it's above 70. But still, it's not very high. It could be nearly anything between 70 and 10 to the 12. It could be 1 million, it could be 1 billion. But still, it is close to the minimum value, which is excellent for phenomenology. Because if inflation is too long, then all the subtle physical quantum gravity effects are beyond the Hubble sphere. So this is a very interesting value. And the fact that the duration of inflation is predicted in the model is something that I consider as very elegant and very strong. Unfortunately, up to now, I have neglected shear. And I cannot do that, because you know, if you add up anisotropies to the Friedmann equation, they scale as 1 over a to the 6, which means that in standard cosmology, they dilute faster than anything. But for this very same reason, it means that they increase faster than anything in the contracting branch, and therefore I cannot generically neglect anisotropic shear stress at the bounds. I have to take it into account. So this is why you can, for example, switch to a Bianchi 1 universe. This is a Friedman equation taking into account anisotropies, and sigma q is the quantum shear that appears in loop quantum cosmology, with pi's being the conjugate variables to the ci's. And you can play the same game and compute the amount of e-faults in this case, and the result is that the PDFs are shifted to the left. That's not surprising. You have less energy available for inflation. Part of the bounce is now triggered by the shear and not by the energy density. And therefore, you have less amount of inflation. That's excellent, because it was already quite small, and now you say it is less. So basically, it means that LQC predicts for a massive scalar field that the amount of inflation is between 70 and 140. And this is something that, to my knowledge, no other theory can predict, at least at this level of simplicity in physics. Then you can go beyond the quadratic potential, that is a massive scalar field. You can, for example, put a linear potential, you can put a kind of string theory potential, or you can put a Starobinsky potential. I like Starobinsky potential, because, you know, it comes from quantum gravity, but that's not the point. Because this is the historical potential, the first one, and very very nicely, it is also the one which is now favored by the data obtained by the Planck collaboration. With the Starobinsky potential, the game is somehow changing, because it's a flat potential. So what happens here, that you have so much energy available that it can throw the field away into potential. So the neat result is that as soon as the potential is confining, this result basically holds. But if the potential is too flat, of course, you can still have a lot of inflation, even when taking into account the dynamics of the universe in the contracting branch. Okay, let's go beyond the background now, and let's try to take into account the perturbations. That's the difficult part. I have only 5 minutes available, or 10 minutes available, so I will focus only on tensor modes. You know, tensor modes are the easiest ones, both because of gauge issues and because of anomaly freedom issues. So, a very interesting approach has been developed, called the Dressed Metric Approach, where people are really trying to deal with quantum fields on a quantum background using very nice and powerful theorems from loop quantum gravity. So the Hilbert space is really defined as a tensor product of the Hilbert space from the background and the Hilbert space for the perturbations. And you really quantize everything at the same time. And the neat result is that the wave function for the perturbations is basically a standard Schrödinger wave function, but instead of filling the classical metric, it fills a Dressed metric, which can be analytically computed. So nu and pi are the configuration and momentum variables. BH is basically the Hamilton function for the background, and the equation of motions for the perturbations can be explicitly written, where Q is related to the standard gauge invariant Mukhanov-Sasaki variable. And at the end of the day, this U tilde potential is just a Dressed potential, which is a quantum counterpart of this classical U potential. It means that you have everything you need to compute your spectrum of perturbation. And this is exactly what is done. And you end up with something like that for the power as a function of the wave number, which is the inverse of the length scale. So these are large scales and small scales. And the interesting point is that you now have a deviation from the nearly scale invariance that is usually predicted, not in the UV, but in the IR. It might seem strange. How can that be that quantum gravity, which is a theory of a small length, appears in the infrared, that is for big sizes? it is not so surprising. Because what happens here is that those modes begin to feel the curvature of the universe. Please remember that the main effect of quantum gravity here is to have an impact of the curvature of the universe. But if the universe is curved, only the big modes feel the curvature. The very small modes still see a flat FLRW Minkowski space, you see. So it's not that surprising that the largest scales are the ones that are feeling the quantum gravity effects. But the problem, in a way, is that those modes, just because of this reason, have no strong arguments to be put in the Bunch-Davis vacuum. In a way, the Bunch-Davis vacuum is not anymore defined. So you can use the Lyubov transformation and you can pick those modes in the vacuum you want, and therefore the spectrum can be changed to account better for the data. So the good point is that you will fit very well the observational measurements, for example for the scalar modes, not for the tensor modes, that are not yet measured, as you know. But the bad point, of course, is that your model is now less predictive because you have more freedom. The problem with this very interesting and promising approach is that consistency is not ensured. You know, gauge fixing before quantization is often harmless in physics, but not in gravity, because in gravity, you know that dynamics is part of the gauge, because the Hamiltonian is vanishing. So we have to be very careful in gravity. And it is not clear in that case that the subtle consistency conditions that are basically encoded in Einstein theory in the fact that you have a first-class Dirac algebra still holds. This is why a second approach was developed, called the deformed algebra approach. Here, this is less quantum. This is less deeply rooted in loop quantum gravity, but at least the theory is consistent. It's consistent means that the vectors of evolution are parallel to the submanifolds of constraints, and this is what you want. So there is no gauge issues and no gauge anomaly. It's a generalization of JR. I don't know if this is the correct one, but it is one. And the point here is basically to put a so-called holonomy correction, where k bar is replaced by this periodic function. There is even an additional integer here that I have not written. And what you have to do is simply to compute all the Poisson brackets between the quantum corrected constraints. So these are the structure functions that are not constants. They depend on the Hdk variables. But the problem is that if you do that naively, you have anomalies, which means that your algebra does not close as you would like it to do. So you have to add up contour terms that will be required to vanish at the classical limit. And the very interesting point that I find very beautiful and somehow magical is that all the integers appearing here, all the contour terms that you add up by hands, are completely constrained by the structure of the theory. There is a solution and a nearly unique solution. And at the end of those very, very lengthy calculations up to second order in perturbed variables, you end up with this algebra. These are the Poisson brackets between the diffeomorphism and the scalar quantum corrected constraints. And if you know JR in this formalism, this and that are exactly what you have in general relativity. This is Einstein theory. The only difference is this omega function here, where omega is 1 minus 2 rho over rho Planck. So when rho is small, omega is 1, and you end up with JR, hopefully. But when rho is equal to the Planck density, omega equal minus 1, which means that here, the sign is changing. But this sign here basically tells you whether space-time is Lorentzian or Euclidean. So it means that in the theory, close to the bounds, space-time becomes Euclidean. It means it's not space-time, it's space. You don't have time anymore. That's somehow magical. You know, this is something postulated, for example, in the Hartle-Hawking theory, just as to make the Feynman integrals converge better. And this is something which also happens in quite a lot of quantum gravity theories. But here it happens dynamically. You see, dynamically, you see time disappearing and space-time becoming pure space. And somehow time would appear as a kind of symmetry breaking in the very early universe. That's great. But I don't know if that's true, because this is seen only for perturbations. It cannot be seen for the background, for obvious reason that the Poisson bracket is vanishing, so 0 equals minus 0. You cannot see it, right? But still, the validity of this result is questioned. But if real, that's something extraordinarily elegant. And this is a kind of dynamical realization of the BKL conjecture, you know, because now all space points decouple at this silent surface defined by omega equals 0, that is rho equals the Planck density or the critical density divided by 2. So there would be an Euclidean phase around the bounds. You can compute the equation of motion of perturbation in this theory. That's more subtle than in the previous one, because now you have the omega term here. So there is a kind of hyperbolic spheric mixing. And you can compute the spectrum, which looks like that. Two comments. First comment. Interestingly, we have shown that for large length scales, there are some universal LQC predictions. Both the Dressed metric and the deformed algebra lead to the same spectrum, and the reason for that we are not sensitive here to the subtle corrections to the equation of motion for modes. We are sensitive to the background evolution, which is obviously the same for both approaches. So that's very, very, convincing for the theory itself. In the UV, we have now this kind of exponential divergence of the spectrum, which in itself is not a problem, because there is a natural cutoff, of course, in the UV anyway. But the problem is that if inflation is long enough so that the observational window falls here, which is generically the case, of course it is excluded by data, because we know, for example, from the Planck observations that we don't have a lot of gravitational waves in the universe. The scalar to tensor ratio is bounded. So it cannot be true. You could fine-tune the amount of inflation so that the number of e-folds is small, and therefore the observed part of the spectrum shifts to the left. But this is still excluded, because in that case, due to the subtle dynamics of the background, the contracting branch, you have to have a deflation phase. And because of deflation, the normalization of the spectrum will increase, and this is still excluded by the data. I like that very much, because we have a quantum theory of gravity which is meaningful, which is well grounded in diffeomorphism invariance, which predicts, of course, JR as its infrared limit, which predicts inflation, and which is excluded by the data. So, you know, we have all heard many times that loop quantum gravity, or quantum gravity in general, is metaphysics. Well, by the way, I love metaphysics. But still, this is wrong. Here, we really can exclude, not of course the whole LQG or LQC, and not even the deformed algebra approach in itself, but a very specific setting where back reaction is neglected, anisotropies are neglected, transplanckian effects are neglected, and so on and so forth. But at least, there are some subfields of the theory that can be excluded by current data, and to me, this is an extraordinary good news. By the way, I have just mentioned transplanckian effect. Please do keep that in mind. If you take a generic value of inflation, for example, 140 e-folds, everything you see in the CMB is much smaller than the Planck length at the bounce time. We cannot continue to ignore that. So one way or the other, maybe with modified dispersion relation, we have to take that into account. To me, it's a very important thing to work on for the forthcoming years in loop quantum cosmology. Let me conclude with black holes. I mean, there are a lot of things to say about phenomenology of black holes. We have recently shown that, for example, it's possible to distinguish in the Hawking evaporation spectrum of loop gravity black holes between standard models and the holographic models. And I have also shown that it could be that the line structure of the loop gravity black hole can be seen even arbitrarily far away from the Planck scale, which is something I like very much, but this is not related with cosmology, so I will not go into those details right now. I want to use my last 3 minutes to tell you about something which is deeply related to cosmology. You know, in cosmology, the universe bounces not when it reaches the length, the Planck length, but when the observable universe reaches the Planck density, which means that its size is approximately 75 orders of magnitude greater than the Planck length. It's not at all at the Planck length. So it was assumed that maybe something equivalent happens for black holes, that black holes actually are bouncing stars. And there are very good reasons for that. In that case, we would not have any more an event horizon, but instead a kind of tracking horizon, right? And what happens is that the standard classical black hole solution is glued to a standard classical white hole solution exactly as the contracting phase of the classical Friedmann equation is related to the expanding phase of the standard Friedmann equation. And somehow quantum gravity allows a tunneling between both classical solutions. So this is the Penrose diagram of those bouncing black holes. And this part here is basically the quantum regime of the bouncing Planck star. The very interesting point is that the bouncing time is m squared. You know, the Hawking time is m cubed. It means that the bouncing time is smaller than the Hawking time, and therefore the bounce is faster than the evaporation, and therefore evaporation might be seen just as a kind of dissipative correction to the bounce in quantum gravity black holes. So you can compute the metric and you can explicitly show that it makes sense. And the point I just want to make to conclude is that you may really estimate what is the structure of the signal released in the universe by these bouncing black holes. Of course, it does rely on different hypotheses. You have to emit quarks and to calculate the fragmentation function of quarks and how they hadronize and how the neutral pions decay, etc., etc. But you can do that. And we have shown that the spectrum has this kind of characteristic shape. And the part of the game that I like very much is that the way this signal depends on the redshift can be explicitly analytically computed. And there is a very weak redshift dependence for physical reasons that we understand very well, and which makes this signal completely different from any other kind of a source of photons you can imagine in the universe. So you see that both with cosmology, with black holes, and possibly also with modified dispersion relations, there are open windows to try to test loop quantum gravity, and I find that rather exciting. Thanks.